Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subject we all grapple with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth. What's on your mind?
Pay attention to the wolf moon that we had last night, this large supermoon on the first day of the year that illuminated everything. I really try to stay aware of changes and the natural cycle. And so I love the first of the year. I love New Year's, not because of parties or anything like that, but I really love this sense of transitioning from one time to another, and this idea that I have a do-over or a new beginning, or I don't know, just this opportunity to reflect on the year before. I go through my calendar from the year before and remember all the things that we did and get to re-experience the joy and, you know, remember how much fun we had. And then I also check in with the challenges and the things that didn't go well, and I sit with them and then process them and then kind of let them go. Either write them down and burn the paper or just kind of release them into the universe and make space, kind of clearing away space. It's kind of like I'm rebooting my internal emotional computer. So I have to, you know, get rid of my storage that's almost full and then make space for new experiences to come in. So I love this time of the year. I love the idea that we have the opportunity every day to do better, to start over, and every year to kind of reset. And last year, my goal, and I don't like to say resolution, you know, because it feels daunting and there's such bad press about how few people are successful. So I really think about kind of these goals or things that I'd like to accomplish. And last year, I set out to do something for 5 minutes, 5 days a week to better myself. Didn't matter what it was. It could be making a phone call to a representative. It could be doing plank for 5 minutes. It could be stopping to have a conversation with someone that I would usually maybe avoid or rush by, but to like stop down my life for 5 minutes, five times a week. And after I talked about it on the show last year, my friend Trish showed up at my house and she left two jars. One was filled with pennies that represented 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week for the entire year, and then went to drop them in as I accomplished it. It was such a beautiful gift. And I noticed that I didn't do great with my goal. I would hope that I did at least 5 minutes of bettering myself enough throughout the year. But when we talk about changes or setting goals or intentions, you have to recognize when you're accomplishing the thing that you intended to do. And so my idea with this was to drop that penny in and every day and pay attention to what was the thing that 5 minutes of betterment was. And I didn't do great, so I'm re-upping it again this year as my challenge to myself. So thank you, Trish, for the pennies. They're back to square one, and I'll be dropping them in throughout the year. The other thing that I'm thinking about as we enter into the new year is, how do we find the motivation or the inspiration to charge into the next year? You know, especially when things maybe haven't gone well the year before, maybe our health has been challenged, our mental health has not been well, we've had loss, we're experiencing grief, we've had disappointments, right? It feels like the universe is working against us. How do we look at the calendar for the next year and say, I'm ready to take it on? You know, where do we find that internal fortitude? Because there's a lot of platitudes we say, you know, just look at the joy in your life, write down happy things, look on the sunny side. There's a lot of platitudes out there. But when you're really feeling beleaguered and weighted down, it's hard to find that. You know, you might even write down 5 things you're thankful for, but it doesn't alleviate the pain that you're feeling or the challenges that you're experiencing, right? Just noticing 5 nice things does not heal your health. Just noticing things you're grateful for does not make your mental health improve, right? Just having the cliche responses of, we'll look at the sunny side, doesn't improve your actual life situation. And that's where a lot of people get frustrated, because they feel like they're doing everything right. You know, they're on a diet and they're writing things down and they're exercising and, you know, being a good person, and things still aren't going my way. And so people get frustrated, or they give up, Or they might turn to experts who promise all of the answers to everything, right? When we feel like we can't do it for ourselves, then we'd hand over our power and look towards all these other sources to give us inspiration or to help us achieve our goals, whether it's a diet guru or an exercise guru or a mental health guru or a fitness guru. You know, all those things exist, or a medical guru who promises good health. And when we hand over our power and our beliefs to this person as being the one who will save us, and it doesn't work, then where do we turn? So I'm thinking about those ways that we step into the new year and find the will to go on. And so I was thinking about, what are the four characteristics that we need? You know, there's four characteristics that we need in our life to help us move forward when we can't go any further. And fortunately, I get to read Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, almost every other quarter at school because I assign it to my students. And I feel like if I don't keep current with the book, I can't teach it. So I've read it quite a few times. And if you're not familiar, are you familiar with Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning? If you're not familiar, that's your reading homework for the next few weeks. We can talk about it again, because Viktor Frankl lived through a concentration camp in Nazi Germany, and he writes about it. But a lot of people, you know, when they first pick it up, think, oh no, it's another painful story about someone's experience in a Nazi concentration camp. I can't go there. But that's the first half of the book. But the second half of the book is all about what he took from that experience and how he created a life for himself of meaning and value and worth. And so thinking about this new year, I was drawn back to what I was reading again, and I remind myself every quarter when I read his book that Viktor Frankl's idea of life is much different than our modern view of what our purpose or meaning in life is. You know, if you look at the media, if you turn to what our popular cultural messages are all the time, the idea of life, the meaning of life, is to entertain yourself at all times, to try to be happy, to fill your life with distractions and things that give you joy. That's why our screens are so fun, because you can be addictively distracted at all times and think that you're pushing that serotonin button into happiness. But there's really no depth behind it. Viktor Frankl said, you know, when we look for the meaning of life, it has to do with happiness, but nothing like happiness as we see externally, but really about having that understanding of what is our why for living. Why are we living? And we all need to find that why, because if we're living just to be entertained, we're never going to be entertained enough to overcome hard times. But a why is someone who needs us, a child that we're raising, a grandchild whose life we're a part of, a spouse, a neighbor, an aunt, an uncle, someone, a person that is counting on us, or work that feels important, whether it's working, teaching, or giving to others, or as a health professional, or, you know, a janitor cleaning a school so the kids have a safe place to go, having work that feels meaningful. He said, when you have those whys for getting up every day, then the how we live day to day becomes less important, right? If I had fun or felt happy, that how we get there, even if it means we're struggling and feeling overwhelmed, the how can be daunting, but the why we get up and slog through our life becomes a thing that gets us through. So those things are all on my mind, from this New Year's to start over, Viktor Frankl's work, this idea of what are those things we need as individuals to carry on going into the next year. And then I was thinking about why I do this show. And we talk about it a lot, you know, it motivates me to get up and do this every Tuesday. It's because the majority of our mental health concerns, if you look at the research about mental health, the majority of them are situational. They are depression and anxiety and fears and phobias are not biological in their foundation. They're situational. Traumas happen, experiences happen, the world happens, life happens that trigger these feelings of anxiety and depression. For 90% of the people, those are the things that trip up our mental health. It can cause biological reactions, and then we feel the biological changes. But what triggers mental health issues most of the time are situational. And so I do this show to help encourage people to look at the ways that they can address their situation and take control of their mental health or feel more power in making changes in their life. And the way I've found that I can continue feeling inspired to do this is by bringing stories to you about regular people who have found ways in their life to feel inspired or motivated, dedicated, and balanced. That isn't shown in the media. They aren't authors trying to push a book or experts trying to teach a fitness routine. They're not people that are out there searching for the public attention. The people I love to bring to you are people that are everyday people that I meet in my life going about my business who are living in such a way that I feel inspired to do better. I feel hope for the future because it's just the everyday people that are doing so well. So I thought, what better way to kick off the new year than to invite one of my favorite inspirational people into the studio to talk about her life. Because I've talked about her life and her journey in my classes. I hold her in my heart when I'm feeling discouraged. And I thought it's time to bring Laura McKenzie in to tell her story and share it with you. Because those four things that we need to maintain our mental health and well-being are motivation, inspiration, dedication, and love. When we have motivation to do well in our lives, to be our best person, and then we have the inspiration, something that inspires us to do well and be our best person, and then we find that fortitude, the dedication to stick with this inspiration when times are tough, and then we have the love for what we're doing or the person we're doing this for, those four things can sustain us for our life. And my guest today, Laura McKenzie, inhabits all of those four characteristics. So we're going to invite you into the conversation in a bit. Our number is 805-781-3875. This is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can find us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or at our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. And please, if you can, subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist, and the shows will be downloaded every week for you to enjoy at your leisure. But I'm looking forward to this conversation and sharing Laura's inspiration with all of you. So we'll be back in a moment to continue our conversation.
I'll give a little bit of my love to you. There's so much that we need to share, so send a smile and show you care.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and my guest today is Laura McKenzie. She is a friend. Our daughters have grown up together. Molly and Kelly went through school together. So we met the way a lot of people meet their friends as adults is through their children's activities. But Laura also has a son, Sean. And I came to respect and admire Laura in a special way because of her relationship with her son, Sean, and his struggles with autism growing up. How old is Sean now?
He's 24 years old.
So he's a grown man now. But I've been able to be a part of watching Laura navigate her experience parenting Sean for 10 years, I think. And so I wanted to have her in to talk about her experience. Laura is a wife and a mom of two. She's an educator. She is an incredible artist that she doesn't talk as much about, but a beautiful artist. And she's also in the process of starting a nonprofit to help other families who are struggling in the ways that she and her family have find their way. So, Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Thank you for the opportunity to tell Sean's story and to reach out to other people who may be walking that same path.
And it's interesting that you say share Sean's story, because when I think about how I know you and your family, I feel like this is so much your story. Your story as a mother and finding your way and leading your family and guiding your son. And although it's Sean has been the beneficiary of this and he's done a lot of work on his own, he needed a guide and a mentor and a mother like you to get where he is today. So I feel like today we're talking about Laura's story. Is that fair?
Okay, fair enough.
Okay. So let's start back to where I knew of your story. I remember one of the early conversations we had when I was just getting to know you, and you said, my son Sean started out off the charts intelligent, growing rapidly, thriving on all accounts, and then the lights went out. Can you start there with your story of Sean?
Yeah, you know, we started out with this beautiful, healthy baby boy, our first child, and he seemed to be going along just fine. And then, in fact, he could memorize names of animals and all kinds of things. We thought, wow, this kid's just brilliant. He's going to be something someday.
And
amazing.
How old was he at this point?
So this was, you know, when he was probably about 2, 3. And then we started to notice some changes. People start, like preschool teachers said, you know, he just plays parallel play. He's, you know, we said, oh, but he knows all this information. He can say all these things. He's fine, you know. And don't worry about the social skills. He's just a little eccentric, you know. And we started, we did know that he liked doing repetitive things, but he was so verbal at the time that we kind of would joke a little bit about, because of the repetition behaviors about autism, but kind of off the cuff. But we said, but he could talk, so he couldn't have any problems like that. He's just fine. But then it by the time he was 4, there were things he couldn't do that he could do when he was 2. Mm. You know, we started
so
to see this
regressing decline.
Yeah. Absolutely. And by the time he was 5, we had been taking him to the doctor saying, no, you don't understand. There's something not right. And they just couldn't put their finger on it. And he ended up continuing to struggle once we entered school. It was clear something wasn't right. They would evaluate him and say it's PDD and OS, pervasive developmental disorder, or something, you know, delays. No one could put their finger on it.
And no one was saying autism.
No. And then, by the time he was 7, things were off, you know, off the rails hugely. Clearly, there was something wrong. He couldn't function at school or at home. He was severely hyperactive, and he always had kind of, you know, been that way. But things were, his behavior was getting unmanageable, and his interactions with people had become very different. He would run dialogues of movies or things that he could memorize all of that, but he couldn't really have a conversation with you. We ended up taking him to UCLA, and he was admitted there and through the emergency room, because things had become so dangerous, really, for his own behavior, because of his own behavior. And the emergency room, it's funny, we took him in there, and he was taking the place apart. You know, they put us in a room, we're trying to contain him, and they start taking all the equipment out, taking more out, and then they're trying to get him calmed down, and he's just, you know, off the walls.
And was this your day-to-day? Were you home full-time with him?
I was teaching part-time and home with him as soon as school got out. You know, I would get him, and this was nonstop. And he had a younger sister, Molly, who's 2.5 years younger than him. And she was kind of taking the brunt of some of this behavior as well. And
so was it aggressive behavior, you'd say? Or?
Very, very physical, nonstop. Mm-hmm. He absolutely was starting to have some real aggression. But he would do things that were very exciting to him, but kind of dangerous. Like he'd get out and on the highway and run out in front of cars because it's extremely stimulating, apparently. You know, he loved that sensory input. And so we were having a hard time keeping him safe.
Mm-hmm. And it's not what people, when we talk about autism, you imagine someone who stops communicating, withdraws, becomes very passive. Right. So he was having a different experience.
Yeah, and he was experiencing the world, and he was very much in his own head, and the behavior he was doing, he was really unaware of how it was affecting people around him. He was really operating in his own world. And when we took him into UCLA, the ER doctor came in, he just was kind of furious with us. He said, you know, has anybody mentioned autism to you? It seemed really obvious to him. What he was looking at there was clearly autism. And Sean ended up staying as an inpatient for a month there at UCLA and received his diagnoses and of autism as well as bipolar disorder. And it was the beginning of answers, but not solutions necessarily.
Right. So getting the diagnosis, which is what a lot of people hope they're going to find relief in. Once I know what the problem is,
we'll
fix it.
Right.
But that really wasn't your experience, that there wasn't just a fix now that we knew what was wrong. And also I need to, just from your perspective as the mom who has, right, you get married and you have a family and you have this vision of what it's going to be like and you start off with this child that's just brilliant. I mean, there must have been a part of you that was angry that this was happening.
There was a grieving, really.
Yeah.
When you really accept that your child has a disability, that is going to be something that he's not going to be doing what you thought he was going to be doing, and it really was grief. Mm-hmm. It was a real change, and there was a story called Going to Holland, and it was about someone who starts off on this trip and they think they're going to Paris and it's going to be great, and then they're in the air in the plane and suddenly the captain announces, actually, we're not going to Paris, we're going to Holland. And you just kind of mentally have to kind of make this shift, like, okay, we're heading somewhere different.
Mm-hmm.
We were very much in the moment in survival mode, just mm-hmm. really trying to day-to-day get through what needed to be done, figure out what we could do to help him, get the supports, you know, that we needed. UCLA had directed us to the regional center and then also, you know, doing special ed at school and, you know, trying to kind of circle the wagons to find out what supports were there to help us to do what we could for Sean.
So did you find that there was anyone who knew enough to be a guide for you?
There was a behaviorist, Jenny Sullivan, and she was kind of our, she knew all, you know, and she was extremely helpful, and she was contracted through the regional center. And those behaviorists that would come into the home and help us to get strategies in place and to do the best we could under the circumstances. But what happened over time, as Sean started to head towards puberty, and he got bigger and stronger, and also there were a lot of budget cuts going on in the state of California, mm-hmm. and the behavioral supports they eliminated the in-home behavioral supports, and school was really struggling with him as well. And we reached a point of, I had always sworn I'm never going to be one of those mothers that don't label my child. Mm-hmm. I would never medicate my child, and I certainly would never place him anywhere. That's just the most horrible thing I could think of. And yet we were standing at that precipice.
Right. That all of your best intentions and your 24/7 personal care and your family resources, I mean,
and it was,
it drains it all.
Emotionally, financially, physically, we were going, you know, down because of the, we were getting overwhelmed. And, you know, my husband he made an observation, and thank goodness for my husband. He really is a great advocate for Sean as well. And he said if we had kept going the way we were going, our family would not have survived. And then Sean wouldn't have the supports in place that he has today. We wouldn't be intact in the way that we are just to be able to support him today. And we were watching that with Molly as well, the struggles that she was having. She did not feel safe in her own home. And the effects that this situation was having on her and her development was a big concern as well. And I couldn't choose. You know, you can't choose between your children.
It's a Sophie's choice,
yes,
right?
Yes, it really was. Mm-hmm. But it came down to the day that the decision was made. He was one more time out running out in front of a car, and I couldn't catch him, and I was almost there, and I thought, I'm going to love him so much and hold on to him so tightly that I'm going to watch him die right in front of my eyes. You know, I mean, it became life and death, and I had to surrender. I had to just say, okay, that we cannot keep doing what we're doing. Someone's going to get hurt. It has to stop.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today is Laura McKenzie, and we're talking about her and her family's journey raising her son, Sean, who had severe autism. And We're talking about his early years and coming to the point where you had to make the decision that we can't be all things for him now, and there isn't enough community support in this moment. So you had to make some tough decisions moving forward. And where did that take you?
Well, I'll tell you, that was the darkest time. That in that moment, we did have to place him in a group home, and I walking away from there, you drop them off and they get them all lined up, and you're walking away and you're thinking life is never going to be okay again. That there's no coming back from this, and it just felt so hopeless, and I was really afraid that he'd never be able to come home again. So that was kind of the depths, and that began a 5-year odyssey of trying to find a place, a group home that could meet his needs, that was safe. Unfortunately, his behavior required that he be in a facility for other people, you know, for people with extreme behavior, which meant he was in with a bunch of kids like him, and he took a real pummeling. I mean, it was a very difficult experience for him. He was 10 years old when we placed him, and he experienced things. At the time, he wasn't able to really communicate that clearly, you know, and later on when he got older and was able to give us more details about some of his experiences, it was so tragic, and yet we could not bring him home. Mm-hmm. We knew that he was not having a good experience there, but there were no other options. You know, if we sent him out of state to a program, we ended up having him down in Los Angeles, down in the Ventura area, for the majority of his placement. We would drive every weekend and get him, bring him home for the weekends. We knew that he needed to emotionally be connected to home. He needed to have hope that he was going to get to come home. And we knew we couldn't just abandon him, you know, drop him off and go. Mm-hmm. So we made we drove our car to death, you know, making sure we picked him up constantly and had him home as much as we could.
And so when you placed him at 10, was the expectation that he would get to a point where he would be able to come home, enter school? Like, the hope was that he was going to get the services and the behavioral training he needed.
We had hoped absolutely that that physical maturity, brain development really helps with impulsivity, that having him in an environment that could physically keep him safe and alive, mm-hmm. and then physically stop those behaviors that were getting very habituated is the word, you know, where mm-hmm. just they get in this routine. And they were able to physically stop that. They had the staffing there to do what we couldn't do.
And so two things worked in your favor. When you found a place for him to be stabilized, mm-hmm. but then as he grew and matured over those 5 years, his own development
yes.
helped to calm some of the behaviors.
Yeah, and absolutely. You know, heading into puberty, the your chemistry is all off, and also your brain is still having a lot of development. Even our normal, typical kids get pretty out of hand at that. They can, you know. And they really stabilize. You get them around 15, 16, and things start to gel a little more. And he had that. His impulsivity really improved. His motivation also, he realized, wait a minute, I want to go home. What do I have to do to get out of here? He really felt like he was in jail, you know. And we really wanted him home again. And we took a long time before we brought him home because we wanted to make sure that the supports would be in place. And this area has gotten a lot better at the supports that they have to offer. When Sean was young, there weren't really a lot of autism programs and supports. In fact, we piloted a few of the school autism programs. In Lucy Amar, we were some of the first people in some of those. By the time he came home, they were just starting to get their autism program a little better. He was in high school at that time, and we really needed to make sure that when he came home, it didn't fail. We could not send him back again. We knew that would ruin him emotionally. I mean, he needed to know that when he came home, he was going to have the security of being home, and he was safe, and it was going to be permanent.
So I think this is about the time that I met your family, mm-hmm. when he had just returned home. And so how was that transition? Because I imagine for Molly, had been an only child for 5 years, mm-hmm. and having her brother come back, how was that transition for everyone?
She you know, it was a big impact on her life, for sure. And she loves her brother. She always has loved her brother. And she was a little anxious, though, when he first came back, not knowing what to expect. And he was much, much better when he came home. He keeps saying we should have brought him home a year earlier or more. He's like, I was ready. But we didn't quite have everything in place. And when he came home, we had a struggle with the school, really. You know, he was coming out of an intensive autism program that was specifically set up for people. And we came into back into high school, and they didn't even want to give him an aid, you know, one-to-one aid, or and they didn't have a, really a program in place. And we ended up having to get a lawyer and, you know, do a, you know, our IEPs were comical. We would sit around a conference table, literally, with all, you know, full, just to have our educational meetings with the district, trying to make sure he got the supports he needed so he would succeed.
And you had to take this on yourself because there wasn't, you were the trailblazer. As you said, you piloted a lot of these services and programs that Sean was able to get into and now other people have benefited from. I mean, that frontier woman perseverance is really amazing because, as I said, you brought him back home in that 24-hour care and making sure he had a life and a place. Because at 15, were you thinking, now he will live with us for the rest of his life?
I mean, I really was. You know, the regional center had told us that people with the kind of disabilities that Sean has, that by the time they're about 24 years old, that's about the level they'll be functioning at. So they were really they were saying you really, really need to work on these, on his skills, you know, getting him
life skills,
mm-hmm. absolutely, because they said you have a limited window. So that played an important role in where we went from there. When he first got home, it was about how can we keep him home? As he approached 18, my husband started, you know, really kind of pounding the drum for Sean to live independently. And I wasn't for that. I was like, no, that wouldn't be good. And he insisted. And I'm so glad that my husband insisted that Sean really, as soon as he turned 18, we really needed to get him going on the independent living. And that was absolutely right. The tricky part was getting, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. How do you take this person who, you know, who can't take care of themselves and teach them to learn, live independently?
And to trust the world outside of your home to be safe.
To trust him in the world. How's he going to function? And how are they going to respond to him? Mm-hmm. That when he was, I don't know how much time we have here on this little window, but he... you know, when his behavior was pretty wild, he'd go running up to people and bark in their face when he was little. And they'd, you know, he went up to a mother one time with her little 4-year-old, and she just decked him because he just went barking in her face and she didn't know what to think. And, you know, you worry, how's the world going to respond to him? I'll tell you something about our community in Oceano, our primarily Hispanic community, and they are so family oriented, and they really take care of their family members who are disabled, and they really seem to understand. And Sean would get out in the neighborhood, and they knew kind of what they were looking at, and they were really patient with him. One time, he ran up to this group of the teenage young men that were walking down the street, and he just goes running up to them and barking at them. And I thought, oh, they're going to deck him. He's going to get hit. And they just looked at each other and kind of smiled and looked at me. And I grabbed him and headed on home. They knew, you know, they're like, don't. I said, I'm so sorry. They said, no problem. They knew. So I love our community there. They're very supportive and helpful.
My guest today is Laura McKenzie. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX, and we'll be back to continue our conversation.
So give a little bit, oh, give a little bit of your time to me. See the
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875 if you'd like to be part of the conversation. I started off the show today talking about moving into the new year and having this opportunity for new beginnings and do-overs and fresh starts and how much I love the opportunity to kind of rewrite my story every year, to look back and reflect on who I've been or how my life has been lived and make corrections and let go of things that aren't serving me well and make room for new opportunities. And I also like to look for those inspirations. What are those things that inspire me to get up every day and live my life? One of my inspirations is my friend Laura McKenzie, and her life as a wife and a mother and an educator and an artist. And she's talking about raising her son, Sean, who was diagnosed at 7 with severe autism, and their family's journey to getting Sean to a place where he could live independently at the age of 24. And we're talking about those four key ingredients that we need to pay attention to have the perseverance to get our life in a place where we feel whole and balanced. Those four ingredients are motivation, inspiration, dedication, and love. And so, Laura, as we talk about your journey with Sean, I mean, that motivation, I would imagine, is to make sure your child can live a life that feels meaningful to him and not just be a ward of the state or a disabled person, and then inspired by seeing his successes and being able to capitalize on them. And then, of course, your dedication as a mother and the love that we feel as mothers. So you inhabit those four things. I'm sure they come out in your other parts of your life. But one of the things that I recall is the thing that I first caught my eye was Sean's love of fishing. And no one can see you as I can see you, but you don't look like a fisherwoman. You're an artist, but people would be surprised. But fishing has been the theme, or I guess I don't know what you call it, the catalyst that has given Sean the ability to live an independent life at 24. Let's pick it up a little bit about where fishing came in and how we got to where we are today.
Well, and I will tell you that fishing for Sean is life itself. Mm-hmm. You know, it is his motivation. It's his inspiration. He's completely dedicated to it, and it is what he loves. So
he'll talk about it forever.
Absolutely.
And,
and that's what we found is if you want to meet Sean, if you want to be with Sean, you have to step into his world in some ways, and that was fishing. And we discovered that when he was 3 years old. We took him out to Pismo Pier, and he caught his very first fish. In fact, the other day I asked him about that. I said, "Do you remember your first fish?" He said, "Yes, it was a barred perch, and I caught it on clams."
So he remembers every bit.
He absolutely remembers it, and he remembers almost all the fish he's ever caught that were notable. I mean, he can tell you where he was, what kind of gear he was using. I mean, he has this photographic memory for fishing. He'll tell you what year it was, maybe the depth he was fishing when he caught it. I mean, he loves everything about fishing. And that's where we had to meet Sean. I mean, if we wanted to connect with him, even when he was in the group home and was going to be coming home, it was all about arranging the fishing trips and making sure that he could get plenty of fishing time. And that was his joy.
And when you talked about fishing trips, it was all kinds of fishing. You were out on commercial fishing boats and up in the Sierras.
Lakes, beaches, piers, boats, whatever, you know, any kind of fishing, bring it on. He's very skilled. I think a lot of fishermen would see just he and I out there a lot because my husband would be at work and I'd be with Sean, and they'd take pity on us and teach us all these great fishing skills, and Sean picked them up quickly. And Sean had became a very skilled fisherman. So
those two things start to happen at once. At high school, he's coming towards 18. High school's going to end. Those community support systems are going to go away.
Yes.
And opportunities for independent living. He has one thing he loves, which is fishing. And as I said, every time I saw you, either coming back from a fishing trip or about to go on one, and you wore all the gear, and you're out on these commercial fishing boats. Sports fishing boats. Constantly. And there was a moment one night when you were coming by to pick up or drop off, and you said, Sean said to me today, "Mom, I don't know if I'm going to have any kind of life. I need to have a life." And you, in that moment, realized that for him to have a life, he's going to have to connect with fishing on a daily basis. So what did you do?
So we went down to Hartford Pier. There's a sport fishing place down there, and we were familiar with them because of all the fishing we'd done. And I went in and I said, "You know, I have a son. He has autism. He loves fishing. Would you be willing to let him volunteer for you?" I said, "I don't know what he can do for you. He can't tie his shoes, but he can name any fish you pull out of the ocean." And they were so kind. And it was just the end of the fishing season. And they said, "You know what, come back when the season opens in April and talk to Debbie." We came back and Debbie got the owners, the captains, all the crew, everyone in agreement to let Sean volunteer. And they all had to be on board for this to happen. And so Sean began volunteering out there at Patriot and sport fishing. And I remember the first day that the boat went out. I brought Sean, and the sun was just coming up, and the boat is taking off across the ocean, and I hear the captain say over the loudspeaker that, you know, welcome to the Patriot. This is Captain Sal, and your crew today is Sean and Mike. And that was the beginning of life, and I just was in tears watching that go away. And I had no clue what was going to happen out on that boat and how Sean would do, and he did great, and it was a match made in heaven.
So how long has he been working on the Patriot now?
He's been there since, it's probably been 7 years, something like that.
And so he found his why to live.
Absolutely.
As Viktor Frankl would say.
He has his why. Why do you get up in the morning and take a shower and brush your teeth? You know, because mom won't take you fishing if you don't.
If you don't, exactly.
Because that's what you need to do to fish and to be out in the community. You know, what? Why do you organize your gear in your apartment? Because you got to take care of your gear so you can keep fishing. You know, why is he engaged in the real world? You know, and it's all about, it starts with fishing, but that brings him into real social skills, real living skills. Even the phone, you know, learning how to call on the telephone, sending texts so you can send your fish count to people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, skills that otherwise he was absolutely not interested in, but that are necessary life skills using a phone, that even started because of fishing.
And that, I guess, is the thing that I always admired most for you in you was that you stuck with Sean until you found his why, until you found that thing that gives him a reason to get up in the morning. Because when, as a parent, we're thinking about, well, we want our children to have a good education so they can get a job and a career and find a mate and start a family. You know, we have those inspirations. But when you looked at Sean and you're thinking, well, he probably isn't going to have a career or maybe find a mate or raise a family. So what would be his reason for being
Where's
here?
His joy?
You
That's
fought
right.
and fought for him to have this why, which was not your comfort zone because you're an artist and an educator.
Yeah.
And so to have the perseverance to get up at 4 a.m. and go out on these boats with him, I mean, how did you find that motivation yourself
that
and
is
stick
love.
With it?
That is, you know, how could you not do that? If you saw your child, if you saw what brought them great joy, you can't not do that for them.
So that felt easy for you.
It really did.
So for other parents, you know, who are struggling with children with behavior issues or autism and feeling like that trip to Paris they were expecting where they thought they were going to land has taken them another direction, what are some things that you've learned that you wanted to share?
I had to let go of what I thought it should look like mm-hmm. and really be honest about what it really looks like and then go there. You know, okay, if it's about fishing, then it's about fishing. Let's make that happen. And be sensitive to his what's working for him, not what I think should be working for him.
And maybe redefining success or
absolutely
what?
And he, you know, he thinks of his he was saying one day, you know, I'm so lucky, my office is the boat out on the ocean. You know, he said I'm the luckiest guy in the world. You know, I have my dream job. And it's all he wanted to do was be a deckhand, and he does volunteer. We did some vocational training and tried to go in that direction so that he could, you know, work to support himself in that, but there's some skills needed that aren't going to be happening for him. And that's okay. He still has his place out there. He still volunteers out there. He's a great deckhand and incredible friends. They watch out for him out there. One day his fishing tackle box got stolen. And that was devastating that would happen out there. And about 2 days later, the guys out there at the pier, they figured out who did it and what happened. And 2 days later, his tackle box showed up full of new fishing gear also. So they take care of him. They watch out for him. They love him.
And as a parent, right, we want our children to find their place in the community.
Yes.
And we have to have some trust that there are good people in the community.
Yes.
Because I think another part of our world right now is that we tend to look out at everyone with suspicion or fear, or being taught through the messages in the media or the stories that, you know, pop up on our Facebook feeds or however we get our news about how bad things are. But really, we have to experience each other as being loving beings, or that trust that other people are going to step in when we can't be there. And you've had to hand your son over to the universe a bit. 'Cause
yeah.
I don't know if...
Yeah.
we didn't mention that he is living independently, that you were able to find an apartment and a place for him.
And that took a willing landlord to, you know, in the same way that going to the fishing industry and saying, well, here's my son.
I
don't know what he'll do here, but are you willing to try doing the same thing and having them be willing? I'm so humbled by that big heart that so many people have, the willingness to help. And it was the same thing with the getting him an apartment and going to a landlord and saying, well, he's never lived on his own before and he's got autism and I'm not sure how this will go, but are you willing to give it a try? And to have someone say, yes, let's give it a try, and have it go well. I mean, it's gone really well. And but you don't know until you ask. But there are people out there who are fearless and willing to give a chance, you know, to somebody. And I'm just humbled by that. And it's been life changing for Sean and for our family as well.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875 if you feel like joining the conversation. My guest today is Laura McKenzie, and we're talking about her journey of motivation, inspiration, dedication, and love that helped bring her son to a place where he's enjoying a full life at 24 in the best capacity he can find. And I think that's part of the challenge also is finding what is that realistic expectation we can have as parents, whether our child is autistic or valedictorian or somewhere in between. You know, do we have realistic expectations of what we can expect for our children, or do we have the trust to send them out and to fall flat on their face and know that they'll be able to get up again? I mean, there's a lot of trust we have to have.
Well,
as parents.
And in the world as well. And I mean, I would be remiss if I didn't mention, you know, some of the pieces of this puzzle that absolutely had to be in place. And family was a big part of it. My parents were a big help with him. My sister-in-law was a huge help with him. You know, the fishing community is huge. Our friends and neighbors and people that we could not have gotten, you know, survived without their help. So this isn't a one-person show at all. This is about a real community of loving people.
With the idea of
afraid
the village,
to step up.
The true idea of a village.
Yeah, it really has been. It has been that experience, and from professionals to just neighbors, you know, it's taken everybody. A lot of pieces to this puzzle.
How do you feel you've changed through this experience being Sean's mom?
I'm a completely different person. You know, I used to, when I was young, I'm going to be a great artist and I could paint for 3 days, you know, and nothing else could distract me. And my journey has become so much. At first it turned into just survival mode. Mm-hmm. Not all those great big I'm going to conquer the world ideas, but oh my goodness, how are we going to get through today? Mm-hmm. And then to learning to love unconditionally, absolutely, you know, forgive, see people not for their symptoms, but for who they really are. And I mean, it's just completely changed my perception of what life is even about. You know, that my purpose is not as self-centered. I've got this great idea for this painting. That seems so shallow now compared to, you know, what are we going to do to make sure that he, you know, that Sean has what he needs today. Completely different focus. It's not about me anymore. And I'm grateful I have been changed in that way. Absolutely.
And so now that Sean is launched and in a good place, you've found a new why or a new passion. Let's talk about the formation of your new nonprofit and what you're hoping to accomplish for the community.
Well, we're really this is a work in progress that's just beginning, and I'm calling it the collaborative independence model. And it's about helping people that have disabilities, not just autism, but this can be mental health, traumatic brain injuries, all, you know, any kind of struggle that might allow them, cause them to not be able to live independently on their own, and they might need the supports in order to be successful and live independently. I'd like to kind of share the model that we have with Sean that seems to be working. It's been about, he's been living on his own now since he was 18, so about 6 years that we've been able to keep him in an apartment and utilizing supports that are already there. We've done the same thing with another client who has a traumatic brain injury and is blind, and then another person who has schizophrenia. So we've kind of used this, it's a formula really, and what I'm all about is sharing that formula. Hey, this works. If you can get these pieces in place, you know, this person will not have to live in a group home or in a restricted environment. They can live out in the community successfully.
And for parents who are aging, I always see that fear in parents who are getting older and their child is getting older and they're worried about dying or not being able to take care for them. Care of them, where will they go?
And I, you know, something that I've seen that, you know, that really, when I first got Sean home and I thought, no, he's home and we're going to take care of him at home, I hadn't thought about, you know, well, what happens when we can't take care of him anymore? You know, I mean, and that's now obviously a big concern. And that's one of the important reasons when I see people who are caring, you know, wonderfully for their disabled adult at home, I mention, you know, what are they going to do? You know, do you have a plan in place?
Down the road.
And now is the time, really, to start developing those skills, to get the pieces in place, the in-home support services, get a place to live, the Social Security in place, the in-home support services, you know, get regional center supports if you can, so that that person has what they need to live independently when you can't take care of them anymore.
So it sounds like what you've been able to do through your fortitude all of these years is find all of these services that are there and do exist, but pull them together into one package. And that doesn't seem to exist right now formally.
Right. You know, there are groups, Parents Helping Parents and Autism Speaks, and that know about these some of these different supports. But I want to be kind of a clearinghouse that shows how they fit together most effectively. Mm-hmm. And everybody's a little bit different, but we have found this kind of combination of services to be successful, to work. So I'd like to help anyone who's wondering, how do you make that happen? I'd like to have a place where they can go to find out, this is how, this is what it looks like.
So what are some of the steps you need to take moving forward if people were interested in finding out more about it? Or, you know, where are you hoping to be a year or two from now with the, and is it going to be called the Collaborative
Independence
Model? Is that your title of the nonprofit, or?
For today, it is. I would like to have it online, absolutely, so anyone can access it anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's a model that can work in any state, you know, anywhere in the country. You're not just restricted to where there are state programs already in place or facilities in place. This could be applied anywhere to any. So I'd like to have it, you know, online. You know, have phone number for, you know, it's a clearinghouse for information. It's not a new state program. Mm-hmm. It's really a clearinghouse of how can you make those programs work together for you.
So you're like the advocate.
Yes, very much the advocate.
And are people finding you saying, you've done so well with Sean, how do we do this for my family? Is that how it started?
It really did. And finding that there were other people trying to do the same kinds of things, but everyone's kind of reinventing the wheel. And so I wanted to have a clearinghouse or a place where people could call and get that information or go online and see it for free. Again, it's not creating some new program or trying to seek funding for anything. It's like, no, all of these pieces are here. This is how you put them together.
So if someone wanted to find out more or contact you mm-hmm. and be a part of this, how do they get a hold of you? What would be the best way to make contact?
You know, I have my number is 473-1519. That's the 805 area code. And my name is Laura McKenzie. I would be happy to answer any questions or help in any way that I can. As we continue to develop this and formalize it more, we'll be able to get the information out online and, you know, better. And through, I'm sure KCBS would.
Yes,
KCBS would.
We're happy
pass
to
that information
pass
on.
The information on through my website or through our Facebook page. And also, I'd like to think that this is our first conversation about moving forward, because you've kind of opened up a new beginning for yourself, being an advocate and someone who is starting a nonprofit. So, one more thing to admire about you, Laura McKenzie.
Thank you
for coming and being my guest today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. You can find out more by liking our Facebook page. You can leave us a message there. You can also send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. I'm happy to put you in touch with Laura. If you'd like to listen to previous shows, please visit kcbx.org under the News Talk tab, or check out Apple Podcasts, A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and subscribe to listen to shows at your convenience. As always, I appreciate being a part of this community. I appreciate the listeners, and thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX. We'll be back next Tuesday to carry on.
Everywhere. I'll be the moon when the sun goes down, just to let you know that I'm still around. That's how strong I love is. Whoa. That's how strong I love is. That's how strong I love is, baby, baby. That's how strong I love. Swimming when you were here, and I'll be the rainbow after the tears are gone. Wrap you in my colors and keep you warm. That's how strong my love is, darling. That's how strong my love is. All the tears whenever you cry. I'll be the breeze after the storm is gone, to dry your eyes and love you on. Oh, oh. That's how strong my love is, baby. That's how strong my love is. That's how strong my love is, darling. That's how strong my love is again. There's so much love.